This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
So tonight's show, I am bringing in Joshua Cutchin, Michael Hughes, and Red Pill Junkie, and we're going to be discussing some of the top stories of 2015. And this is going to be in two parts, but the second part is going to be the more standard midweek podcast that we've been doing. But this first part is going to be the main show, because I think some of these stories deserve some spotlighted coverage here. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. Happy New Year.
Indeed. So Red Pill Junkie pretty much put this list together for us.
Yes, you've seen, you know, some of the news that were posted at the Daily Grail throughout all of 2015, and others that weren't, because, you know, for whatever reason, but I managed to remember. So hopefully we can see what of those were, you know, the ones that will highlight 2015. In our memories.
Or low light.
Exactly.
let's start with a low light, and I think that is the Roswell slide.
Oh man.
You have to peel that scab off.
But here's something interesting. I listened to I'm a little behind listening to Jim Harrell's paranormal podcast, and I listened to one from November, and he had Thomas Carey on there insisting that the controversy for the slides is not done.
Of course.
But the thing is, in listening to, you know, initially I wasn't even going to bother, and I said, no, let me see what he has to say. And I'm realizing that part of the problem is he's so set on believing it that I think he really does. Like, he just can't accept that this isn't what it seems to be. And when you listen to him talk on there, he says things like, well, I had the slides dated, or we had the slides dated, and it fell between, like, 1946 and 1948 when they had to be, you know, taken or whatever. And he goes, if it fell any other time, I would have ignored it. And I'm thinking, why? So that's the only time a picture of what you thought was an alien could be taken?
That's the only time the aliens crashed in our planet. Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, he made other comments like, what was the one? There was one that I was just, you know, he's trying to determine who these people were who took the slides. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, well, they had a picture of Eisenhower, and he's smiling right at the camera. From this, he then says, so they were good friends with Eisenhower.
Of course.
And I'm like, okay, I think I'm seeing the issues here with this whole thing to begin with, is that, you know, you're looking for it to be something. You're not looking at it as, what is it? You're looking at it as, this is a Roswell alien. What do I have that supports that hypothesis?
Confirmation bias.
Yes.
The will to believe.
Yeah. I think it's just emblematic of this Roswell disease that has festered at the heart of ufology for a long time. I mean, I think that it's just something that, look, I think that there was something interesting that went on there. Yeah, I do. But everything is so confused, and it's so far in the past. I mean, let's move on, guys. Let's take a look at something else, you know? I mean, my greatest fear is that we beat Rendlesham into the ground in another 40 years, you know. That's something that I don't want to see happen, which, you know, I almost think sometimes if we had less dialogue about Roswell, we would actually get more out of it.
Possibly. Mm-hmm. Possibly. It's because it's looked at as being the smoking gun, and it's not the smoking gun.
Are there smoking guns in ufology, I ask?
I don't think there are, because I think we're looking at the wrong things. Mm-hmm. You know, is there a smoking gun that we have extraterrestrials who visit this planet? And whereas we may have extraterrestrials if it's a planet, I don't think that the UFO phenomena is indicative of that. So as long as we're looking for a smoking gun to prove that, we're never going to find it.
Yeah, I also think that people in this field are waiting or expecting a quote-unquote magic bullet. You know, yeah. Like in the case of Rich Dolan in his book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, he from time to time thinks of possible scenarios that could kickstart the quote-unquote disclosure thing that so many people are waiting, like the Christ, the second coming of Christ, right? And one of those things that could elicit such a thing would be a mass sighting of UFOs, something that could be recorded by a gazillion cell phones from a whole different angles, and that would be so undeniable and so prescient and so out there that the governments of the world would not be able to cover it up. They would throw up their hands and say, okay, yeah, we knew all along that these guys were visiting us from elsewhere. And I'm not so sure if a mass sighting of UFOs is as culturally important as a mass of individual UFO sightings. You know what I mean? I think that a mass of individual UFO sightings in the long run, you know, something that will take a lot of time, but slowly but surely would have a greater impact in our culture. And that's what I think that's been going on, you know, a grassroots type of contact. Not the spectacular thing like Independence Day kind of thing that everybody will say, oh my God, they're here. And some of us will get to brag and say, see, I wasn't crazy after all. I don't think that's, as I grow older, I think less and less that this would be likely.
I agree.
Yeah, and I think that in terms of the smoking gun idea, I mean, if I recall correctly, in Paul Kimball's Best Evidence Top 10 UFO Sightings, Roswell is not one of those cases, and they're all really good cases.
surprise.
Yeah, exactly. I think those are, if we can have anything that approximates a smoking gun, it's that. But even then, I mean, this comes back to something that we've talked about on the show before. There is no proof of anything yet. You know, there's highly suggestive stuff, but that's about as generous as you can be.
Yeah.
Well, I think we can prove that there are things we can't explain.
Well, I mean, yeah, and the caveat that I would slip in there is I think that there is as close as you can get to proof with psi phenomena in certain quarters.
You know, I myself make a distinction, maybe it's an arbitrary one, between the difference between evidence and proof. You know, evidence is finding clues, and hopefully that you are on the right track, but you still need to keep looking, you know? You still need to do the homework. Proof is that whatever you were looking for, you already found it, whether it was what you were expecting or not, but you already found it, and it's undeniable, and everybody can agree with.
Right,
so from that basis alone, I, someone who's been interested in this field for, I don't know, as long as I can remember, can unequivocally say that there is no proof of UFO alien visitation. Mm-hmm. However, I think there is so much compelling evidence hinting that there is an undeniable there's an undeniable reality to this that we need to search for it.
Something's going on. We just don't know what it is.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. I mean, when you talk about evidence and you look at the preponderance of evidence, like let's take the Tehran 1976 case, you know, where you've got ground visuals, you've got radar tracks, you've got multiple pilots seeing a structured craft of some sort. You know, I mean, there are cases like that. We're swimming in a sea of evidence, but I completely agree, Red Pill, is that It's no proof of anything. And like you said, Soraya, we have evidence that something weird is going on, but that is far from, you know, taking it as far as saying, yes, it is aliens, or, you mm-hmm. know, or even any other explanation.
Yeah. The critical mass of evidence that generates proof has not been reached yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Correct. That's a good way of putting it.
And maybe we'll, you know, I mean, as you know, I think we've all sort of, you know, danced around, you know, this particular idea is that, you know, maybe this phenomenon does not, you know, is doing things for its own reason. You know, it's playing with us. It's toying with us. It doesn't want to stage, you know, the big Independence Day, you know, White House lawn landing thing, you know, and when I start thinking along those lines, I think, wow, it's, you know, what is, if that's the case, then what is the agenda? And I think Red Pill, you know, when you said this, like a grassroots, you know, contact program, I think that's a really interesting lens to look at it through, you know, that this thing is just building a mythology with us, in very small secretive steps, but collectively it's had an enormous influence on people's beliefs, you know, maybe not the guys that want to pin down the proof, but, you know, the average person out there, you know, is pretty much living in a culture, a worldwide culture that has a mythology that there are some kind of beings that you know, appearing in our skies and messing with us and who knows what else.
Yeah, maybe this program or these manifestations will, after a long, long time, will reach a critical mass that it will eventually shift our perspective in such a way that we will no longer be waiting for this smoking gun, because we will realize that the smoking gun was staring at us all the whole time.
Yeah.
Well, let's look at one of the other stories that's sort of related to this. It was entitled Aliens Under the Scanner.
Yes. And this was something that don't remember.
It was showing the connection between the type of brains that abductees have and those who have experienced trauma.
Exactly. I think it was this neurologist in Hawaii. That's very sophisticated MRI machine, you know, to scan the brains of all the people, all the patients that came to him and said, well, I think I was abducted by aliens. Mm-hmm. And the guy, what interested me about this particular story was the guy wasn't the typical snarky dismissal. Oh, well, you know, all these people are crazy. You know, he tried to remain neutral and say, okay, you are claiming this fantastical story. Well, here is this scientific instrument I have here at my disposal. Well, let's use it. Let's see what we can find. And he did find, apparently, these interesting correlations. I can't remember exactly what those. I think it was maybe in the parietal lobe of these guys' brains or something, but enough of an evidence to indicate some kind of link. And obviously, a materialistic skeptic will say, aha, you see? So this proves that the alien abduction is nothing but something that is generated by the brain, but we could spin it the other way around and say, well, or maybe there is something in the brains of these individuals that in some way can trigger more easily some time of non-ordinary state of consciousness that could somehow elicit some sort of contact with non-human intelligences. Mm-hmm.
Or we could look at it very literally, and that these people have been traumatized by their mm-hmm. by their contact mm-hmm. experiences as well. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. and I really love that story because it's an interesting sideways way of looking at the contact phenomenon, you know, instead of just hypnotism, you know, this it's just a really, you know, novel, and you know, and I just love the fact that it's you know, it's very empirical, you know, the data, and what it says to me. I mean, I do look at it kind of literally. It's like, no matter you know, what the literal reality of what happened to these people turns out to be, that their brains are showing signs that, you know, they were traumatized by, you know, presumably by these contact experiences. So, mm-hmm. and that's pretty major, I think. It's you know,
yes.
Well, and I would throw in here, although it's far too early in the program for me to start talking about Terrence McKenna, but
it's never too early for Terrence.
this is the part of the brain that functions at mostly, I mean, it's one of its primary functions is language processing, which I mean, again, I'm not going to go into all that, but anyone who is familiar with Terrence McKenna's thoughts will definitely see some degree of significance in that. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, our entire reality is created by language. So I think that there might be some sort of link there as well.
Well, I find it interesting because it also connects to Kenneth Ring's work. I mean, because what he found is that the people who had near-death experiences, the people who experienced alien abductions, often had trauma in their past, mm-hmm. often were abused as children and stuff. He called them encounter-prone personalities, I believe. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, this here is what you have is a physical, you know, verification of what he found just by talking to these people and having the, you know, and surveying them and doing his research.
So step two, get shamans into the study and see what's going on with their parietal lobe.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also in the article, it's interesting. It talks about Persinger's God helmet and how when Richard Dawkins put it on, he pretty much just got a slight headache. And it makes me think too, that, you know, the God helmet might be opening us up to other things. It's not just that it's creating something in the brain. It might be opening up the brain, and certain people just may not be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of,
you know, I've met people who were very materialistic, very closed off to anything slightly outside the norm, and I find that they've never had any kind of weird experience in their life. Yeah. And it could be that their brains just don't perceive them.
Or they did have those fringe experiences, but somehow they have chosen to dismiss it or not take it seriously or try to rationalize it in any way possible in order not to break their flimsy worldview.
Mm-hmm. Also possible.
Well, and as you said too before, Red, you know, perhaps these people are God deaf, you know, as opposed to tone deaf.
All right, Red Pill, you want to pick the next story?
Ooh, you know, one of my favorite stories of last year, because it was so, you know, nonsensical. It was the story of the alien hybrid super spy.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really interesting, that was a really interesting story. And I felt like it had more legs than most super spy stories, because I felt like the more that you pulled back, you just kept on seeing more and more of this really bizarre story with the people around him believed this story as well, and the amount of guns and cars that he had amassed seemed to imply that he was getting funding from some sort of outside source. I mean, I think there was something going on there. I'm not so far willing to say that it was alien super spy, but something was strange about that entire case.
So I'm not sure what this case is. Tell me a little more about it.
Okay, so there was this story that broke in the news in the American media about the body of this male Caucasian guy who was found dead inside of a vehicle. He had been dead for quite a while, apparently. And slowly the yarn of this story started to unfold, how the fiancé of this individual and her assistant were convinced that the body of this man was eventually going to be picked by the secret government, because they were absolutely convinced that this individual was a reptilian human hybrid. You know, and that's the story that he kept telling to his fiance and this other woman, and apparently all the women in his life, because there was this very interesting article that was published, oddly enough, by Playboy magazine. But it even though it was a really good, very thorough investigation about this guy and all the things that were apparently going on behind in his life. And long story short, apparently his fiance wasn't the only woman who was convinced that he was a alien hybrid. So long story short, the guy apparently managed to amass such a fortune of guns and resources because he was a hustler, the kind of person who can convince a woman or even, so I guess, a man to of anything, you know, even the most preposterous of stories. Like, yeah, you know, I'm a secret spy, and I'm a alien human hybrid. I'm here on a secret mission to save the world, so I need you to sleep inside of your of your bedroom's bathroom. Trust me, I know this is for a good reason. And all these women did what he wanted. You know, it's just so bizarre. All these well-educated, well-to-do women who did this guy's bidding. And also for a Mexican like me, it's so bizarre to notice how a man in the United States can literally amass the kind of arsenal that would let you take a small country in Latin America. You know, you could arm you could have your small private army, and no one in the government of the United States bats an eyelash. No one in the FBI or the DAA or the CIA say, wait a minute. I mean, what's the deal with all these guns that this guy kept in all these secret warehouse all around Los Angeles and God knows where else?
And then it's a bizarre story.
Yeah, and
people sometimes are so easy to, like, if you have the right charisma, you can convince people of just about anything if you get the right people.
Exactly. I think that, and this is me going all conspiratorial, but I think there's some significance in the fact that we haven't heard any follow-ups, because I feel like it was such a weird story that, and it got such legs. I mean, you heard about it in a lot of different places. Yeah. That if it was just nothing, I feel like we would have heard something about it by now. Of course, I haven't dug to look if there's anything like that, but I feel like we're not getting the whole picture here. Like, and I'm not necessarily thinking that, like I said, that he was some sort of alien operative, but perhaps there was some sort of government connection there, or that he was, you know, operating in some sort of, maybe even some sort of well taken care of civilian informant capacity or something. I don't know, but something doesn't quite sit right with me in that whole story.
I don't know. I mean, my own personal take is that this guy was, like Soraya said, someone with so much charisma that he could have easily started his own cult. You know, just like Applegate with the Heaven's Gate. Mm-hmm. But instead of that, he chose just to exploit these women and collect all these guns because he happened to like guns.
Yeah, I think the prosaic explanation might be the right one for that. But, you know, who knows? It was definitely just completely bizarre, and I agree that it really dropped out of sight, so maybe we can all look into it and revisit, see if anything else has transpired.
All right, for the next story, let's go in a different direction to ancient cultures, and first of all, Graham Hancock released Magicians of the Gods, which has been, you know, forthcoming for many years now, that he's been working on it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I've read it yet. I've read almost everything he's ever written, nonfiction wise, but I haven't gotten around to picking this one up yet. Have any of you read it?
No,
I have not either. No, it's on my list to pick up.
Oh, Mike, I was expecting you to read it in an afternoon,
like the Mike Clellan messengers session.
Right? Yeah, I did blow through Clellan's pretty quick, I got to say. I've been following what Graham has been posting. You know, little bits here and there. And,
yeah. So have I.
You know, it really seems like it's furthering his theory, you know, the wider sort of theory that, you know, there was a very complex, you know, pre-cataclysmic civilization. And, you know, he posted something today about some cave art, I believe it was in Indonesia, and also some Australian cave. You know, the timelines just keep getting pushed back further and further. And, you know, I really feel like we're on the cusp of really, you know, commonly understanding as a people that there's a big chunk of our history that's just completely been hidden for a long time, and that we go, that our civilization goes back a hell of a lot deeper into history than we've thought or we've been taught.
Well, and can we all agree that this is edging close to proof? Yeah, I mean, this is getting close to that proof.
It's getting there.
I think so.
And I believe Graham puts the core of this ancient civilization in Southeast Asia around the Gaudam Pondong temple and that area in itself. And then, of course, you have the what happened at the end of the Ice Age, which is, you know, open to interpretation, depending on which researcher you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Graham looks at the theory of a, does he say, is it comet or does he believe asteroid?
No, I think he thinks comet.
Mm-hmm. I think it's comet,
Yeah.
But there's a lot to explain at the end of the Ice Age, because you have one event that then sets us into what seems to be a nuclear winter, and then you have an event that released so much energy that that everything just melted almost instantly.
Right, and it's become maddening to see the, you know, either the contortions that the establishment will put it through to explain away such things, or the just general general apathy that they have for these particular anomalies. And I think it is too. I think it's a slow uphill battle, but I really do think it's getting there.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I sometimes feel that all these ideas somehow are driven by the zeitgeist of the era. Like back in the 50s or 60s, people were thinking of the UFOs, the Space Brothers coming to Earth to try to save us from the nuclear apocalypse, because we were really on the brink of a full-scale nuclear war with the Soviet Union, right?
Mm-hmm, so right.
I now feel that, and not to like disprove or belittle Graham Hancock's work, not at all, but now I feel that the interest that stems from his research and the research of all these alternative historians comes from the fact that we feel that our own civilization is on the brink of like going the way of Atlantis, as he has put it in so many interviews. Like he says that if we don't really take heed of all these dangers that are threatening our existence, like, you know, cosmic collisions for one instance, or our own undoing of the environment, the pillaging of nature and the degradation of the ecosystem, we are going to be remembered as the Atlantis of the 21st century, and, you know, 200, 500 years from now, people are going to make tales of how, oh, our ancestors once walked on the moon or whatever, you know, and 5,000 years from now, the Michael Shermers and the, you know, Richard Dawkins of the future will laugh at those myths and say, well that's just nonsense, you know, that's just myths and stories and nothing to that.
You know, this is really interesting that you bring this up, because I was thinking today about hearing something about people cloning their old pets on Mysterious Universe, and coming back to a conversation that you had about the singularity over on Skeptico the other day. And these ideas of wanting to hold on to things and being afraid of change and not looking forward. Also, you see this in the culture of the times. You know, we're rebooting movies. We're having, you know, revivals of TV shows. All this stuff. We are so afraid to move forward. And I think this sort of, again, not to belittle Graham's research, because I think it's spot on, but I think that we are so afraid as a society to move forward, and I think that might even be our undoing, that we're not looking towards the future anymore. We are obsessed with this infantilization of both our past and the past, you know, our personal past, and also the past of ourselves as you know, as a culture.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. Completely. And our society definitely likes to keep nostalgia alive. They don't want to take chances on new ideas, and it always aggravates me when you hear someone say, well, there's nothing new under the sun, that's why we just keep bringing stuff back.
It's an awfully reductive idea.
Yeah, sure, okay, to a degree there's nothing new under the sun, but you can make new things out of it.
Yeah, it's like saying, oh, well, everybody breathes and eats and sleeps and et cetera, et cetera, so there's nothing new under the sun. Well, no, not quite, you know, there's new ways of saying things.
Yeah, at the fear of going over political here, it also pains me how some people see the current migration of refugees from Syria going to the shores of Europe and trying to go to other safe places, like here in the Americas, not just North America, also on other countries, and they see that like a terrible threat. Like, oh my God, they're going to tear apart our culture. And I listen to that and say, wait a minute. I mean, where in the history of humanity have you seen a culture that's been completely isolated? In the few instances that has happened, it has been the undoing of that particular culture. Take, for instance, I don't know, China. Building the Great Wall because, oh my God, you know, we have to keep away all these barbarians out of our wonderful culture. And what happened there, you know, stagnation, and, you know, their fabulous dynasties ended up crumbling down. And the same thing is probably going to happen in all these countries that are slowly have aging, you know, their population is not getting any older, and they are seeing, oh, it's because we have to preserve our culture, not realizing that every civilization's culture is the result of this amalgamation of different peoples that have been, I mean, we've had, human beings have been migrating and moving from country to country, from crossing the seas, as long as we've been human, right? I mean, archaeologists find mummies of Caucasian people in China who are like 2,000, 3,000 years old, and say, "Oh my God, look at that!" Yeah, well, no hell. This is proof that we've been moving, and haven't been like static, you know. As our old history books were telling us, you know,
I was just gonna say cocaine on mummies in Egypt too. You know, there's tons of these exactly. little anecdotes.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, we're a creature with. Well, I think that's kind of part of what we're wrestling with as mankind, is that we're a creature with wanderlust, and we've made every corner of the world accessible, and for some reason we're not trying to get off planet. And I think that's something that we really should put more effort into and more forward thinking into.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things with the whole Syrian thing that bugs me is I keep seeing posts from people of, oh, Syrian refugees do, you know, committing this crime in Holland or wherever. And when you look into it, it turns out it has nothing to do with Syrian refugees. It was just some kids causing problems. And, you know, they're using it to try and sell this fear of refugees.
Yes.
But and that's, you know, I mean, that's our sort of our xenophobia, too.
Yeah.
Which is growing.
It's growing and it's being stoked, you know, deliberately, you know, to facilitate certain political, you know, aspirations and things. And that's what's scary. Yeah. That's what's scary to me. You know, we talk about cycles in history and, you know, the things I'm seeing surfacing with the xenophobia and the, you know, the fear of the other and, you know, talk of putting people in camps and things like that. You know, I mean, it's, you know, if you're a person that's even, you know, remotely familiar with history, it should scare the hell out of you. And,
yeah,
you know, it's terrifying to me, but I think that's what happens when, you know, civilizations are kind of teetering on the brink. And I really do feel like, you know, there might be a subconscious sort of current under, you know, in a lot of people that we really do, you know, that's why all this dystopian sci-fi, you know, is so common and so appealing to us now, is that, mm-hmm. you know, maybe we feel the ripples coming backwards in time of, you know, things that are going to be happening, you know, maybe we might be the ones who are, you know, being kept out as, you know, people of Florida are massively migrating because Florida's, you know, mostly underwater. So, you know, we're projecting all this fear mm-hmm. on immigrants and migrants and things. And because we, you know, somehow, you know, we know that could be right around the corner for us. That's incredibly speculative. But go ahead, Josh.
Well, I was just going to say the baffling thing to me is, or the truly baffling and frightening thing to me is to see people of moderate disposition move more towards the fringe. And I know people who, in this current election cycle, we're dancing around candidate names, but I know people in this election cycle who I have seen who have been like, no, this guy's crazy. And then I'm slowly seeing them being like, well, there's a point here and there's a point here. And before you know it, they're parroting a lot of these things. And it's really striking to me to see the influence that rhetoric can have on people's minds.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We are ripe for demagoguery to really, you know, to really become the dominant force in politics, I think. I mean, you know, obviously we're seeing that. But, you know, people are afraid for so many different reasons. And, you know, the middle class has essentially been, you know, crushed, you know, over the past few decades. And, you know, there's just a palpable, you know, sense of fear that things are not going to get better. And,
yes.
you know, if you read things like my friend John Michael Greer's The Arch Druid blog, you know, he's one of the most historically savvy guys. I mean, he's just, his breadth of historical knowledge is amazing. I mean, and you know, he very explicitly points out the cycles of collapse that have occurred in the Roman Empire and, you know, all down through history. And when you look at what's happening, it is really, you know, especially as a guy with, you know, two young kids like me, it's pretty terrifying. You know, I'm going to make sure my kids know how to swim, number one. And
speak Chinese,
yeah. And number two, you know, just grow up to be as adaptable as possible, because, you know, things really don't look so great.
Yeah, and this isn't just a political thing or an environmental thing. I mean, the comparisons. I mean, it's. I think we've distracted ourselves with bread and circuses for the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and increasingly so.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back covering the top stories of 2015.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and I'm here with Joshua Cutchin, Michael Hughes, and Red Pill Junkie as we cover some of the stories of 2015, some of the fringe stories of 2015. Let's see. Let's keep with ancient cultures for a little bit here. We have the possible chambers in the pyramid that were discovered, as well as a possible secret chamber in King Tut's tomb.
Yes.
And that's I'm particularly interested in seeing if they find anything else in the Great Pyramid.
Of course, all of us, you know.
Yeah.
See if they use that technology to see if there is that legendary chamber beneath the paw of the Great Sphinx. Also.
Right. Yeah. That's that's been on my list for a long time. Like, can somebody please? please use the best equipment we have to find out whether the hell that's real, there's something or not.
If I remember right, they have found a chamber under one of the paws of the Sphinx. They just can't get to it. They're not allowed to dig down to it, of course. And of course, there was speculation too that whatchamacallit there, the old director of
Zahi, yeah.
Had actually dug down to it and didn't tell anyone.
He turned the idea that he turned it into a bachelor pad.
Oh my God.
One of the things that I believe it was Robert Schock said is that Sphinx at one point was likely on the front of a cliff, and that the entrance to that chamber might be down on that cliff face, which is now completely packed down with sand.
Huh. Interesting.
So that would, you know, that's it. I want to know what's there, but even if they dig down to it, are they going to tell us?
I think it'd be hard to get away with digging there and not having anyone know about it, you know. I guess that's just one of the things we'll just have to keep hoping someone actually, you know, figures out a way to do.
Wouldn't it be magnificent? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, wouldn't it be magnificent if there really was something astounding down there and it's literally sat there for all this time and it's just been right there so close to us. And we just, even with our technology right now, we have no idea what it is.
Yeah, the ARE would have a lot more members, that's for sure.
The what I would hope it would be is records.
Like vinyl records?
Yes, like vinyl records. Well, that would be interesting too, I suppose.
It's the Hall of Records, see, but they were wrong. It's actually vinyl records down there.
But it's all like Little Anthony and the Imperials and just a bunch of stuff that you don't listen to. Sorry.
But yeah, I mean, imagine if we found a chamber deep down underground that had records from 10,000 years ago that talked about the civilization that may have been here.
That would be a game changer.
Yeah, to say the least. For sure.
I mean,
there would have to be some translation, I'm sure, but...
Well, there are so many mysteries associated with ancient Egypt. I mean, having a really thorough set of collections. I mean, again, the cocaine mummies, you know, the sea people, all these unanswered questions that we have that would be really interesting to see if there's some clearer answer to what exactly went on.
Mm-hmm. But do you think we will find these answers in places like Egypt, or should we be looking in places we haven't looked before? Like, for example, we know for sure that the levels of the seas have rose after the end of the Ice Age.
Right.
But subaquatic archaeology is still not as mainstream as it probably should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I think you're right. That may be where we find the real answers.
Yeah. Remember, you guys, that story about this alleged submerged city that they found near the shores of Cuba?
Yeah.
I want to know what happened with that.
I do too. I do. Well, I, you know, not to jump around too much, but what happened to that alleged, you know, Millennium Falcon looking?
Yes.
Thing, oh yeah.
You know,
Baltic Sea artifact.
Yeah.
So the one off the coast of Cuba, I believe they didn't have the rights to go down to.
Mm.
And so they were, if I remember right, they were just holding off trying to get permission to actually do it because they didn't want to give it to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Understandably, I mean, if you found a city that far underwater, you're not going to want to just give it up to someone else to look into.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm going to be the Debbie Downer here and have to say a couple things. Number one, I fear that erosion of the sea might be a little bit more intense in terms of trying to determine the age, because obviously whatever you find down there is not going to be on papyrus or something. But B, also, I mean, all these structures, just by merit of how long they've been down there, are going to have to, for the most part, be stone, which you can't really carbon date. I mean, sure, you can look at, you know, sediment buildup and coral buildup, I think, and get some approximations. But it's, I don't think that's going to be where the smoking gun is. I just don't think that's where the answer is going to be.
I don't know, but if it's at a certain level, I mean, it's
right.
It's pretty common knowledge that you can date, you know, how long the water has been there. Yeah, at that particular depth. So, you know, I guess depending upon the depth and where it's located, just the fact that it exists could date it.
And I think that was the problem, the particular problem with these alleged ruins in Cuba, because it was so deep in the sea, in the ocean floor, that I would say, no way. This could have been built, you know, before the ice. It was even older, you know, like we're talking, I don't know, 50,000, 100,000 years old.
Right.
Yeah. And as far as the Baltic Sea anomaly, I think they are just having trouble getting to it because of where it is. They have a very small window where the seas are actually calm enough to get down there and do any real research.
Okay. Yeah.
And the research they have done has just deepened the mystery as what the hell is this thing? Because, I mean, it's a cement type of structure, and it has weird magnetic anomalies associated with it.
Yes.
But they don't know what it is and if it was ever above water. So that one's a little harder to look into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the people who are doing it won't say one way or another what they think it is because they simply don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I obviously need to bone up on my aquatic archaeology. So,
what I loved is when the tsunami in 2004 uncovered temples off the coast of India.
Yes.
Exactly where Graham Hancock said, hey, these legends say there are temples there. And they laughed at him and said, there's no temples there. And then the tsunami came through and, hey, look, there are temples there.
Yeah.
So let's talk about one of the other things here was the Aboriginal stories of the flood.
Yeah, there's something. Yeah, I remember Greg Taylor, the owner and editor of the Great Daily Grail, really don't remember this story that well, but something about the myths and the oral tradition of the Australian Aborigines pairing really well with the story of the flood, of rising of the water after the end of the Ice Age.
Yeah. So, I mean, but that's not too surprising. It's just impressive that they've kept stories that could go down 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had lists of, you know, land masses that aren't there anymore that have been submerged, and they had names for everything, and it seemed to be a pretty accurate oral record of what was going on.
Well, that's the way that humans passed on knowledge for most of our history, right? I mean, oral tradition, from father to son, you know, the campfire stories, myths. That's the way that we passed on really important information. And nowadays we'll say, no way, you know, no way those guys could remember for so long. But why? Because now we have the attention span of a mosquito, thanks to our modern gadgets of our iPhones and that things that if it's not like less than 30 seconds long, we can't even be bothered to look at it.
Yeah,
so I remember how Socrates used to say that the written book was going to be the downfall of humankind. And even though I don't particularly agree with that, there's something to be said about that. There's something to be said about not flexing of memory muscles anymore.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And, you know, we tend to think, you know, when we think of oral history now, we think of like the game of telephone, you know, where I whisper one thing to you and you whisper one thing to the next person. But we, you know, oral history, you know, we didn't understand that cultures that don't have, you know, written language or that, you know, that are primarily an oral sort of culture, they take that very seriously.
Right.
You know? And it's a very different story. And and so when you pass down that story, you know, that the person passing it down is probably, you know, very, very careful that every element of it gets passed down because they realize the importance of it.
That's a fantastic point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're not going, yeah, I could listen to your story, but I want to go see this movie and then watch this TV show and then play this video game.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. It was this YouTube series I was checking out. And
Also, Soraya, the fact that you and I are such big fans of Carlos Castañeda, you remember how many of the lessons that Don Juan gave to Carlos was in this non-ordinary state of consciousness. Like he will whack him in the back of his, on the back, you know, on the solar plexus. And then is when he will give the lesson and somehow the lesson will be like kept there in store, you know, according to the, you know, tradition or the philosophy of Castañeda, it wouldn't be kept like in the memory of our brains, but in somehow kept in inside of his energetic body, right?
Right.
So maybe even if you don't believe that, maybe there are some ways, some state. Heightened state of consciousness in which you can really store all this incredibly amount of information and you won't lose it, you know, the same way that memory tends to degrade and tends to fade out and tends to get distorted.
Go ahead.
I know from my own experience, I've been given a lot of information in non-ordinary states of consciousness. And although I can't consciously always remember it, it seems to have an effect on me.
Mm-hmm.
Like suddenly it'll change the way I did something. I'm going, okay, why do I think that now? Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you guys know about the memory palace?
Yes.
Idea, mm-hmm. Yeah, that like during the Renaissance, maybe as far back as the Middle Ages, maybe farther. I'm not sure exactly where it began, but the idea that, you know, these people would construct a structure in their mind like a palace, and then each room they could peg an item to. So, you know, they could remember entire, you know, lengthy speeches and things like that just by using this, you know, visual mnemonic device. You know, it was considered almost like a sacred sort of science, being able to build these memory palaces and tag things and all that too. So, I mean, you know, you guys are so right. I know my attention span is, you know, maybe not a mosquito's attention span, but probably a flea's attention span. You know, just because a gnat. Okay, let's go with a gnat. Sure, a fruit fly. And it's really, you know, it's really disturbing. I really have to fight hard to try not to multitask as much and to and to stay focused on one thing and not like flit about, you know, from one browser window to something else, to my phone. And, you know, I think we've really lost a lot as a culture by having the great brain in the sky that's there all the time. You know, I remember arguments about, you know, an episode of a TV show or something, you know, that would take years before someone would finally find out the truth of it, you know. And now it's, you know, everything's so instantaneous. I think, you know, most of our brain just kind of sits there, you know, in neutral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember the days when we used to ask a question like, I wonder how big tortoises can get? And everybody was just like, I don't know. I have no idea. And everybody just went, huh? And just went on, you know?
Yeah. They scurry.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. During those road trips, Dad, why is the sky blue? And I say, I don't know, son. now it's
Google. Why is the sky blue?
Just Google it, kid. Don't bother me.
Well, which is also terrifying in a completely different way. That, you know, these are our gatekeepers now. You know, I think another headline from this year was that Google was going to start verifying the veracity of certain links, which, you know, has huge implications for anybody who's interested in upsetting the current paradigm.
And do you remember the UK was going to start blocking certain esoteric webs? Do you remember that? There was talk. I don't think it ever came to fruition. I think the outcry was too huge against it. But, you know, we're going to block esoteric, you know, anything weird, you know.
Alan Moore say what?
Right.
And I wonder how many people who made that decision or who were behind that decision ever had a psychedelic experience or ever meditated in their life, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And before we get too far away from lost civilizations, we also had the whole meltdown that Zahid Hawass went into when he was supposed to debate Graham Hancock.
That was such a great moment.
That was priceless.
Yeah.
And there you had Zahid just flipping out and Graham being calm and courteous and, you know.
Yeah.
And that was all because of Bivol, because he had some of Bivol's, one of... was it the pyramid alignment that Bivol had initially come up with in one of his slides? And as soon as Zahid saw the slide, he just flipped out.
Yep.
Well, to be truthful, there's been quite a long feud between those two, which was exacerbated recently because of this whole thing that I don't know if you guys have been following with regard to with these two German.
Yes.
Amateur Egyptologists who went inside the great pyramid of Giza and apparently took some small samples of this cartouche that was used by the English Egyptologists in the 19th century to date and say that, you know, that state that the Great Pyramid is in fact the tomb of the Pharaoh Khufu. And those guys apparently took some of the ochre pigment of this cartouche in order to analyze it. And it was, you know, like a complete scandal in Egypt. I think that the poor tour guys that accompanied these guys inside the pyramid were incarcerated. They're probably still in prison by now, for all we know. And it was all... Zahid was somehow behind all of this, you know. It was some kind of like a power war between him and the guy who took his job once he was like kicked out back when the old president. What was the name of this guy? The guy who was
it ousted.
Hosni Mubarak. Hosni Mubarak.
Part of the country.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Hosni Mubarak, when he was ousted after the end of the Arab Spring and all that, so all these things and the fact that somehow Robert Bivol is friends or somehow connected to these guys.
He wasn't even connected to those guys. He knew nothing about it.
Yeah, but he kind of defends him in some way. You know, I don't know if you have followed the the podcasts or the interviews in which he has brought the subject up.
Yeah, yeah. But I think he contacted them or they contacted him or something like that, but it was after they took the sample.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm not saying here, you know, he has been very adamant, and I believe him, that he had nothing to do with this and that he didn't, like, suggested it to them and all that. But I think that, in a way, he's kind of, like, okay with what he did. Like, his argument is, it's reprehensible what they did, but they kind of were forced to do it because of the close-mindedness of people like Zahi Hawass and all these people that, like, are, you know, standing in the way of learning more about our past. And my own personal argument is, well, the problem is that the way they conducted this, the way they did this, completely negates whatever findings they might get, right?
Yeah.
Everybody will say, well, doesn't matter if they find out that this cartouche is in fact, you know, only 150 or 200 years old, and thus, you know, showing that it's a modern forgery. It doesn't matter because they took it illegally.
Right.
Yeah. And it should matter, but then the other thing is, I mean, Zahid used it as a way to go after Bavall, even though Bavall wasn't associated. He also claimed that, you know, they took they stole the entire cartouche, is what he was saying, when in reality they stole a couple of flakes off the cartouche that weren't even noticeable. And when you saw the images of the cartouche, there were these big scratches across it, and he was claiming they did it. And Bavall was able to find plenty of pictures from before any of this happened with those scratches across it.
Yeah, and those scratches more than likely happened when Zahi Hawass was still the Minister of Antiquities in Egypt.
Right.
So, in other words, it happened during his watch.
Yep.
Well, and is there also a sensitive cultural dimension to this, too? I mean, you look at the narrative of the European, these were German fellows, right?
Yeah.
You look at the narrative of the European Egyptologists coming in and, you know, destroying temples and you know, sort of almost procuring national treasures for their own, you know, it becomes a German discovery, not an Egyptian discovery. So I think there might be a dimension of that too, you know.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, I'm being a citizen of a country which was pillaged by European nations. You know, we're still fighting with Austria. You know, we're demanding them to return the headdress of the Emperor Moctezuma that was given to the Emperor, Charles V by Hernan Cortes, you know, after he conquered Mexico. And we're still fighting for that item, you know, that we consider to be, you know, a national heirloom to be returned. And those guys are refusing and saying, no. And after all, this is actually not the real... The real headdress is like a replica, and every time that the Mexican scientists have requested to analyze it, you know, they have to go through all this red tape, because these guys, the Austrians, know that like the headdress, the European museums are so filled with things that were ransacked by all these poor nations, right? That if they were to do the right thing, all those museums will be emptied. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, you know, the problem, the tragedy that we live in nowadays is that if those artifacts were to be returned to their original nations, unfortunately, they probably will be at risk of being, you know, either destroyed by idiots like Daesh. We call them Daesh in the Daily Grail. You know, the ISIS. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we refuse to give them the merit of being called a state. They are neither a state or a representative of Islam in our mindset. And remember what happened in Iraq after the second invasion.
All that these looting artifacts and pillaging. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, what happened with all that?
Yeah. They're sitting in wealthy collectors' homes, I have no doubt.
Yeah.
Well, there was a whole thing with one of the owners of Hobby Lobby.
That's right. Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember her name. There's an archaeologist, Heather something. I can't remember her name. She's on Facebook. And she was writing a book on that and basically was told to stop.
Hmm.
Because she was tracing where all these artifacts were disappearing to.
Yeah, and that's an enormous criminal market in art. I was astounded when I started looking into the illegal art market, especially for artifacts and things. I mean, it's astonishing the amount of money. I mean, it's almost like the international drug trade, you know. I mean, not quite at that level, but it's enormous. And I can understand it, you know. I mean, you know, part of me, you know, I've been at archaeological sites, and you know, if I found some cool little statue, you know, it's human nature. You're like, wow, I'd love to have that. Can I get it in my luggage? You know, I mean, you know, there's something that's still part of the magical thinking that you know, that we have as humans. You know, I mean, it just, you know, picking up a broken piece of pottery or something, you know, it feels like it has some kind of, you know, connection or resonance or something like that. And, you know, that's people feel that they want to possess that stuff.
Yeah.
Which is why every ancient culture should curse their ancient sites.
Exactly.
Oh, no danger.
There's been plenty of cases in which, tourists get like rocks that they like extract from sacred places. Like, I don't know. In Honolulu or Hawaii, you know, the sacred mountains, and they return with those rocks, and they are like cursed with bad luck, and they are forced to return the rock or the item. You know,
those are great stories.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly.
Well, it always goes back to the Brady Bunch. when they discovered the little
tiki
guy, yeah, I mean that solidified it for me. Vincent Price was in those two episodes too. So that made me never want to steal any kind of artifact. Thanks to the Brady Bunch, I learned, you know, a very important lesson. But since we're going through stories, Miguel, and since you took it back to your home country. How about talking about the liquid mercury that was found under the Great Pyramid?
It was found, I think, under the Temple of Quetzalcoatl in Teotihuacan, right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it was under
the Pyramid of the Sun or the Moon. I think it went under the Sun. Yeah,
it's so interesting, you know. I mean, my colleague Rick at the Daily Grail made the very fortuitous comparison between this finding and also this legend that the tomb of the first emperor of China supposedly has also, you know, like large quantities of liquid mercury, because it was supposed to have this representation of the rivers of China, and also like the night sky. And that's not the first time in which people have made comparisons between the ancient cultures of Mexico and cultures in Asia, you know, like China and other places. And It's fascinating. I'm still eager to see what else they can find. You know, I mean, the archaeologists, they had to, you know, like took a rest from their excavations, you know, in order to like get funding and also to prepare for the next season, because they're eager to find whether they can actually pinpoint the location of one or some of the ancient rulers of Teotihuacan, because we really, it's fascinating how little we know about this particular culture, you know. And something that kind of a personal pet peeve is it's a very common misconception to think that Teotihuacan was built by the Aztecs, you know, even though the Aztecs, like, arrived to the Central Valley of Mexico almost, like, 1,500 years later after after the city of Teotihuacan was deserted. But we also don't really know what happened to that particular city. We speculate that the end of the city was pretty violent because there's like remnants of charcoal in the buildings. So archaeologists deduced that there was some kind of fire, and by that they conclude that, well, maybe there was some kind of uprising, you know, social uprising. Maybe, you know, the lower classes like rebelled against their masters, and then the city was deserted or something like that. But the fact is, we don't know. We don't even know the true name of Teotihuacan. Teotihuacan was the name that the Aztecs, or rather the Mexica, which is like the appropriate name for this culture, the Mexica gave to this city when they were passing through the valley of Mexico, and they saw these majestic ruins and say, "My God, I mean, this city, this could only be built by God." So that's the name of Teotihuacan, means the city where men became gods.
Gods.
Well, it's interesting, you know, in a lot of the articles that you see about this Mercury pool, they were suggesting that it was to symbolize the underworld, like an underwater lake. And it's interesting that I believe in the culture of the area around Tulum, there was believed that one of the cenotes actually was a portal to the underworld. And at the bottom of that, there is a layer of hydrogen sulfide. So I find it interesting.
Oh, and also one of the stories that broke last year, which I happen to have written about for the Daily Grail, is the discovery of a cenote right beneath the temple of Kukulkan in Chichen Itza.
Yeah.
Really? Know,
something using the same technologies that have managed to pinpoint this alleged new chamber beneath the Great Pyramid of Gizeh in Egypt.
See, that's super fascinating to me, because I've been on this alchemy kick for a while. And you have, you know, you have this underwater river of basically sulfur, hydrogen sulfide, what a lot of us associate with the smell of sulfur. And you have an underwater river of mercury, and sulfur and mercury were the two opposites of alchemy. And I find that to be an interesting correlation. I don't know if there's anything you can do with that, but.
Mm-hmm. And Chichen Itza, I mean, the name means the city of the water shamans, of the water wizards, right? So obviously water had great magical properties or power for this particular culture. So it's, to me, it's so interesting that they decided to build their main temple right above one of these sacred passages to the underworld.
And so that was part one of a three-part series with Michael Hughes, Joshua Cutchin, Red Pill Junkie, covering the top stories of 2015. The second part will be midweek this coming week as a midweek podcast, which I'm trying to come up with an actual name for that show. It'll be the Where Did the Road Go something, maybe Binary or something to that effect. If you have any suggestions, feel free to pass them along. But you'll get part two in that midweek, and the following week will be the third part as a midweek podcast. We have our third year anniversary coming up, and some really interesting things planned. If you become a patron, you'll get part two of this conversation right away, as well as tons of extras. And you can go back and look at all the extras that have already been put up as well, and listen to them, I should say. There's one video and a bunch of audio clips, and there'll be a lot more to come. So, if you're interested in becoming a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. It's right up there on the top of the list. And lots of interesting stuff coming up very soon. Going to leave you with some Psyche Corporation. This is Worrying World.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. beat. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you hear?